growth is one of those constant watchwords in economics. GDP growth, job growth, the growth or decline of an industry. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. Today's show is all about the idea that growth can sometimes be divorced from the people it affects. Whether it's healthcare costs and how we pay for them, or the kind of energy we use and who produces it, or even what we eat and, yes, who grows it. A few weeks ago, we took you to Dalton, Georgia. It's a small city in the north of the state that makes carpet and is trying to grow and change what it does. Our reporting there grew out of conversations we've had with Dalton's mayor and two other mayors across the country over the past 2 years. Our second trip, and first story today about the struggles of growth, is to Gillette, Wyoming, to see the mayor there and learn about her city and its challenges. Gillette is about the same size as Dalton, a little over 30,000 people. And like Dalton, its economy is deeply dependent on one industry, extraction. That is, getting stuff out of the ground. Oil, gas, uranium, and especially coal. This is Western mining, not the underground maze you might imagine when you think of a coal mine, but huge open pits. You could fit the local airport inside one. They look like quarries with cliffs for sides. Looking down from the edge above, the 50-foot trucks inside seem like matchbox cars. Gino Palazzari, who does PR for the city of Gillette, took us out to the very windy Eagle Butte mine where we could see down into the pit.
What they do is they use very large shovels, and they remove what's called the overburden, which is basically the topsoil, and so that they can get down to the coal itself. It can be anywhere from 5 feet below the surface to 50 feet below the surface.
Wyoming produces about 40% of American coal, and this county, Campbell County, produces more than 80% of Wyoming's coal. It's been a rough couple of years for coal and for Gillette. Residents felt punished by environmental regulations and the shift away from coal on the energy market. Coal production fell to its lowest level in decades. The mines in town laid off hundreds of workers. And most people were bracing for Hillary Clinton to win the election and things to get harder.
Everyone in our community kind of took that as it would be kind of the final nail in the coffin or something, because we'd already had a tough year.
That's Louise Carter King, the mayor of Gillette, and the woman we came to see. On election day, she says things changed overnight.
It was like a switch had been flipped in this town. People went to restaurants that next day. They were full. People were bustling. Just the whole attitude changed in the community. It's just the attitude and hope, and that was just great.
Carter King has been in office for about 2 years. Her father, Herb Carter, was the city's mayor in the 80s. Back then, this was a boom and bust town. Men came to work in the mines and lived in hotels or trailers. When the job was done, they went back to wherever they were from. Gillette syndrome was the era's shorthand for problems like crime and high costs in a transient place. Mayor Carter King is trying to build a more stable Gillette, one where people stay and raise their kids. There are more restaurants now, tons of sports fields, new subdivisions that meet Wyoming grassland. All of this depends on the industries that make the city's economy run. It's not an exaggeration to say that many people here feel like President Trump is bringing their town back to life. Already, he's reversed two Obama-era coal regulations. He opposes the Clean Power Plan, which aims to cut carbon emissions and shift away from coal power. And even though he gives the mayor some pause,
I don't know what to say about him, but as far as energy goes, we feel that he is good for our community. It is very good for our community. And as a mayor, that is our top concern, my top concern.
Thanks to coal, Campbell County traditionally brings in more revenue than any other county in the state. And revenue from taxes on the industry goes to the city, the schools, and into funding places that help create a more stable, permanent community. You can see this play out at places like the Campbell County Recreation Center. It's got three basketball courts, a lap pool, leisure pool, party room for kids, and a 42-foot climbing wall that's a replica of Devil's Tower, the Butte and National Monument that's an hour away.
There he is, Mr. Anderson.
How are you doing this fine day, sir?
The day we went, the former city attorney was practicing his belays. And yes, people here are optimistic about the economy and the extraction industry under the new administration. But no matter who's in the White House, they know the city has to diversify. Because there is one uncomfortable truth about the future of the coal market.
Natural gas is in competition for power generation.
That's Patrick Ladke. He and his brother Paul run Cyclone Drilling, an oil rig company started by their father. They grew up here, know tons of people in town, and just have a great sense of what makes this place run.
The downturn in coal was less to do with regulation by the federal government and more to do with the price of natural gas.
And that's a difficult thing to say out loud in Gillette, where coal is part of the way of life. This is a city that is proud of what it does. And many people feel like the only reputation coal has is something dirty and demonized, when here, it's what feeds families. Here's Patrick Ladke's brother, Paul.
What fails to make the press is that these people are out here providing a service, providing a product that the American people need. When the light switch goes on, it comes from coal generation or natural gas production. And when you go to the filling station, you fill up with oil from a domestic source.
The economics of coal may be hard to escape. But the economy is picking up a little here. Even though more work is automated these days, the coal mines have hired some workers back, and the Ladke brothers are getting ready to put another rig in the field to drill for oil. 25 of their rigs have been sitting idle in a yard while they wait for the energy markets to shift. Across town, we went to see a business that represents the future of Gillette. It's called Atlas Carbon, where they use coal to make activated carbon. The company's VP of operations, Jim Ford, explained what that is.
We took one of our employees here and said, okay, you have an hour and you have $50. Go to Walmart and see what you can find with activated carbon in it. You know, kitty litter to also things like cosmetics, shampoos, you know, facial scrubs.
And no, they don't make cosmetics here. More like huge chemical filters for water and air that remove pollutants like mercury from coal and power plants. Right now, there are 12 people who work at Atlas Carbon.
So everything that we're walking towards right now is the feed-in.
The company can't fill the gap left by the mine layoffs, but its leaders hope to hire more people as the local economy and their production process pick up. Michael Jones is the chief technology officer and co-founder of the company.
You'll see a lot of signs around town that say, stay strong, Gillette, and the community's really kind of rallied around, and you know, we think it's going to improve, and those kind of things are bright for the community going forward.
Atlas Carbon is banking on the future of coal and extraction, not just in its own business, making activated carbon, but in power plants, where burning fossil fuels creates electricity. Like Dry Fork Station. It's one of the newest coal-fired power plants in the country. It runs on coal extracted only yards away and uses activated carbon to clean up its emissions. Gillette is proud of it and its new technology. The plant manager, Tom Stalkup, told us about its grand opening.
There were so many people that didn't think we were running, and it was one of the questions from the crowd, were you even running? And we said, we're not only running, but we're at full capacity right now.
There's no smoke in the sky, and that matters to people here. Even though activated carbon doesn't remove all emissions or greenhouse gases, people in Gillette are sensitive to the charge that they don't care about the environment that they live in. Here's the mayor, Louise Carter King, again.
Why would we do something to ruin our own air? Why would we want to, do that?
And that's part of the balance Gillette is trying to maintain between the industry that keeps the city going and the natural beauty and quality of life that make people want to stay here. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. We'll have more from Gillette in just a little bit. But first, we love our numbers here at Marketplace. It's what we do. So let's dig into some important ones with our producers Tony Wagner and Eliza Mills as they bring us some of this week's news by the numbers. All right, Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
$4.5 trillion.
That's what it'll cost to get U.S. infrastructure a B grade by 2025, according to the American Society of Civil Engineers.
We got a D plus this week.
That's expensive, but the ASCE says not doing anything costs even more. The economic drag of bad infrastructure costs families about $3,000 a year. 183.2 million.
That's how many prime age people will be in the workforce by 2035, according to new projections from Pew Research.
There were just over 173 million in 2015.
It's the slowest growth since baby boomers started working in the 60s. And here's the rub. For the first time since then, the number of U.S.-born workers with U.S.-born parents is declining.
Instead, that modest growth will be buoyed by immigrants and the children of immigrants, Pew says.
$1 billion.
That's how much it could cost to resurrect a woolly mammoth, according to Rob DeSalle, a geneticist and curator at the American Museum of Natural History.
A group of scientists is working on recreating a gene sequence that would result in an elephant-mammoth hybrid.
The first step would be creating an embryo. Then there's the question of whether the mammophant would be carried to term by an elephant or in an artificial womb.
And throughout, the price goes up. You could say it's a mammoth expense.
No, you couldn't. No.
Like I mentioned before, Gillette is working hard to be a place where families want to stay, and that includes growing its local college. We went to a college in Dalton, Georgia, and we did the same thing in Gillette. Gillette College started as a commuter school, but it's slowly becoming bigger and more students live here. 85% of the student population is from Campbell County, and students come here for a lot of different reasons. Sam Harmon is from Star Valley, Wyoming. She's 19 and studying health science to be an athletic trainer.
I am definitely a Wyoming girl. I think a lot of people are undereducated on some of the industries in Wyoming. I know a lot of people are really against the oil fields and mining, which, honestly, they live off the stuff that we mine in oil, you know? If people want cars, they're going to have to deal with that. If they want phones, they're going to have to deal with us having mining and having oil. That's something that our society depends on. And, you know, people attack it for being bad when all reality, those industries are helpful.
Before the election, Sam was worried. But to say things turned around for her on election night is an understatement.
It was amazing. What was it, like 1 a.m. when they officially announced that he won? I could not sleep that night. I was so scared that Hillary would win. Terrified. So I couldn't sleep. And I was just constantly checking the polls like, oh, he's so close. He's so close. It's so exciting. And when they finally like officially announced that they won, I remember like jumping up and down, running out of my room into our living room, jumping on my roommate, screaming, he won, he won, he won, he won. She's freaking out. And then I call one of my coworkers because she's like, well, I'm going to bed. Call me. Tell me who wins. I call her and I'm like, Trump's our new president. And we're like freaking out. It was like one of the most relieving feelings that I've ever had.
Now, Sam says she can see a bright future for her home state.
I guess I have hopes, you know, that Wyoming's going to be okay, that the industries are going to pick back up, that, you know, things are going to turn around and look great. I mean, they are turning around. They're looking way better for our state right now. While Obama was president and while the election year was going on, my dad had to take 3 jobs and my mom had 2, just to get our family through because budget cuts were so hard. But now that Trump is president, my dad has been able to give up one of his jobs and my mom has given up one of hers. And it's starting to get there. Like, our hope is starting to become a reality.
Then there's Kaylee Bass. She's also 19. And like Sam, she sees just how intertwined her home and the people she loves are with the extraction industry.
I come from a family where we've only ever worked industry jobs here. before I was born, my mom worked on the railroad. She took a 6-week maternity leave and then was right back to the railroad for another 13 years after that. And my father, he was a tool pusher on the drilling rigs. And then after he decided he was over that, he went to the coal mines for another 20 years. So I think that a lot of people in this country forget that they work in offices, cubicles. In Wyoming, that is our cubicle. And if those are taken away, we have nowhere to go. I mean, so many businesses run off of the success of those industries, and including my family. If my family didn't have those opportunities, I have no idea where we would be. But I think a lot of people forget that that is our home and that is our lives here.
Kaylee wants to be a doctor, and after next semester, she plans to transfer to the University of Wyoming and then go on to Washington State. But her home is in Gillette, and the thought of leaving is both exciting and a little scary.
I will be the first one to go on to a bachelor's, to go on to a PhD, to go on to MD. In my family, we all take care of each other. And my biggest dream is graduating college and being able to take care of my family. You know, if someone needs help on their rent, if someone needs help on anything, like, I want to be there for them. The University of Wyoming and Washington actually do a program that if you graduate, they'll pay for so much of your tuition if you come back and practice for so many years in the state of Wyoming. So if I follow through with that program, I'll probably come back here for a little bit. But I'm kind of a bird. I kind of want to go everywhere. You know, I don't think I really want to settle down after I get my so many years done. I think I want to actually be a traveling doctor for a while and give back to others in that way. But for retirement and that, like, probably I can see myself having a small little cabin and my own peace and quiet. So I'm not sure, but I know I'll be back.
The last student we spoke with was Michael Welch. He's 37, originally from Casper, Wyoming. He served in the Army from 2002 to 2007, did 2 tours in Iraq. And for Michael, going to Gillette College was about rebuilding his life.
For a long time, for probably about 10 years or so, I just kind of was lost. You know, I didn't know where my place was in the world, you know, and I didn't feel like I had a purpose or anything. So anyway, after I had went through treatment and stuff because I had suffered from PTSD really bad, I realized that I can still do anything that I want to do in my life, you know, and that there was still a whole lot of things that I wanted to accomplish. And getting a college education was one of those. I was awarded a house through a program called Operation Homefront, and they get veterans, you know. At the time, I was homeless and all this stuff, and but they help you become a homeowner. So in June, hopefully, you know, will have met the criteria and everything, and the house will be deeded to me, you know, which is a blessing, you know, and it's amazing. My plans are I want to sell the house, but I want to stay right here in Wyoming, you know, buy property and start, you know. I don't want to say away from everything, but just kind of have my own little piece of paradise, you know. These tattoos here, I've been working on getting them removed. They actually said Kill Haji. When I came back from Iraq, I had a lot of hate. I was going down a bad road. I really was, you know, but things are good now.
These stories are part of a series we've been doing with cities across the country, checking in with the mayors of these places and the people who live there to see how their communities are adjusting to a new administration and the economy in 2017. Next month, we're heading to Corvallis, Oregon, home of Oregon State. Now we're going to turn to our segment, Long and Short. That's when we borrow terms from the world of finance, long as in betting on something, short as in betting against it, and ask our guests to analyze topics in the news. Here to join me this week are Marketplace's Kimberly Adams and Natalie Kitroeff, who covers the economy at the LA Times. Welcome to you both.
Hey, Lizzie.
Thanks.
I want to start, Kimberly, with your short. Why don't you tell us what you're short and why?
I am short on regulations because the Trump administration and the GOP-controlled Congress are just going to town on regulations, especially the Obama-era regulations. I mean, already Congress and the Trump administration have either postponed, canceled, or rolled back dozens of Obama-era regulations, and they've got more in the dock. Congress is using the Congressional Review Act, which is a law that allows them to undo recently passed regulations. They're using that mechanism to undo some Obama-era regulations. And on the Trump administration side, his new cabinet secretaries, as they get appointed, they're going in and just stripping these things out of the way.
I mean, this is such an interesting topic because regulation has connotations on the political spectrum sort of all across the board. For some people, it means big government. For others, it means protections. Regulations in and of themselves, you know, don't have a character to them. They are tools. And certainly how any administration uses them, I guess, is indicative of the tools they want at their disposal or don't.
Right. The energy industry is going to say these regulations make it really hard for us to provide the energy that America needs, whereas environmentalists might say these regulations are important to protect the environment and people's health. Similarly, in the financial industry, you have regulations that consumer protection advocates say look out for the little guy and make sure the big banks don't take advantage, whereas the banking and financial sector says this is increasing costs for consumers across the board, and so we need less regulation in order to function more efficiently. So it kind of depends where you fall on the spectrum, how you feel about a regulation rollback, but I do believe that regulation rollback is happening, which is why I'm short on regulations.
Yeah, which is definitely something I've seen in coal country when we've been recently reporting in Wyoming.
I was going to say that I think there is a lot of black and white in the kind of political discussion, but then on the ground, as you may have seen, Lizzie, in Wyoming, I am finding that people who are actually doing work that are running businesses, there's a lot of gray there. I was talking to a farmer in Stockton, California, in the Central Valley, and, you know, he sort of was talking about Trump sort of unleashing a lot of regulations from the EPA and then sort of how there was some excitement there. He sort of felt that he had been personally in his business held behind by some of this stuff, but then sort of stopped and said, I don't want him to go that far, you know. And I, you know, that moment of kind of questioning just how far this will go, I think is something that's on the minds of a lot of people across the spectrum. And it can feel as though it's a very stark sort of contrast, good, bad. But I think a lot of business people actually have really nuanced views about how these policies play out for them on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, and want certainty one way or the other, because, look, if you're running a business, you kind of want to know, okay, what rules do I have to follow?
Sure.
You are leading us toward your long, Natalie. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm long on farm workers getting a raise in 2017. And so I'm long on this because essentially Trump is promising to ratchet up immigration enforcement. And undocumented workers form, you know, a real core of the labor that's used to produce the food that we make and we eat here in America. And, you know, this is a continuation of Obama-era policies that were also really, you know, tough on the border. And you know, he pursued a lot of deportations. This is something that produced already, it seems, a shortage of labor. Farmers have been complaining about this for a while. Tight labor markets force employers to raise wages. I reported on this. There's a garlic farm in Gilroy that has just promised to raise wages to $15 by 2018. That
wow.
They had a labor shortage. They were short 50 workers. Now they have a wait list of 150 workers, and that happened literally within the first weeks of announcing this policy. So this is kind of a market-driven dynamic, but it'll be good for people who are doing, you know, what can be really backbreaking work.
Gilroy is that farm town in California that smells like garlic when you drive through.
It's a garlic town.
And it's interesting you should use that example because the narrative that you often hear related to migrant labor is that these are jobs that Americans do not want to do and that we can't find people who want to do this work. But this example demonstrates that, you know, if you pay people enough, people will do it, it seems.
Right. We're watching this at the LA Times. And, you know, the what's going on right now, I mean, the wages going up, that's a good sign. I mean, that's sort of what the Trump administration would want to do. You know, if you restrict the flow of people into this country, you reduce competition for low wage jobs. And so, you know, on the other hand, 45%, according to USC, of the workers in on farms in California are undocumented. So those raises aren't going necessarily all the time to American citizens. But the dynamic of reducing the supply and then seeing the value of the work go up seems to be happening.
And I guess one thing to watch there as this plays out is, will those wage raises fill the gap, if you will, you know, and bring enough American citizens or other people into the labor pool, or will stricter immigration policies leave a gap that can't be filled?
And not to belabor the point, but it also gets to the other strange ways that economic spreads has these ripple effects. But, you know, what is that going to do to the price of garlic? And then will people start buying less garlic and therefore it changes the whole dynamic?
Yes.
I want to use this things Americans grow pivot. See what I did there?
Yes.
Natalie, to talk about your short. Tell us what your short.
So I am short on Trump ending legal marijuana. Attorney General Jeff Sessions is distasteful of laws that legalize recreational pot. He has not been shy about expressing that. The Trump administration has indicated that they plan on taking a harsher approach to states that have legalized. There's been a lot of signaling out of the Trump administration, but I'm short on them actually achieving anything. Legalizing pot makes states a lot of money. 8 states have legalized recreational pot since 2012, and the tax revenues have been impressive. Colorado and Washington pulled in $200 million at least in tax revenue last year. Marijuana sales were, you know, $6.7 billion last year. One forecast has them going up to $50 billion by 2026. That is a huge increase. So my sense is that the math is not on the Trump administration or on Sessions' side.
Okay, Kimberly, I'm going to switch gears completely and let you give us your long.
I am going long on space. I'm so long on space because I think that we are really going to see a lot more movement in the space industry, especially the commercial space industry moving forward. Congress passed a bill just this past week authorizing $19.5 billion for NASA in fiscal year 2017. Usually Congress doesn't quite get around to passing funding bills on time, but this seemed to have worked out.
But hey, they did.
And this one does lay out some details about how NASA is going to be doing more research ahead of potential human exploration further out into the solar system, especially in places like Mars. And then on the commercial side, we have Blue Origin, which is a space company founded by Amazon owner Jeff Bezos. This company has been racing with SpaceX in sort of the commercial industry space race, but they announced this week that they actually have a paying customer for the first time. They're going to be taking some European satellites up into orbit, and this is part of their process with Jeff Bezos planning to eventually set up probably a lunar colony, a colony on the moon. And all of this is happening, you know, as the industry in general is just speeding up processes to get people out into space, to ship more products out into space. And it seems like what's happening in the commercial space industry is that they're using space tourism as a way to kind of bankroll their long-term plans. Because we also heard recently from Elon Musk and SpaceX that they're going to take 2 tourists on a trip around the moon. Let's all be jealous together.
Okay, wait a minute. Hold on a second, Kimberly. Is this just like a long game ploy to be the first marketplace reporter in space?
Oh, my God.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It really is. And that's why I'm going to keep bringing it up over and over again.
Natalie Kittura from the LA Times, Marketplace's Kimberly Adams, thank you both so much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Thanks, Lizzie.
This past week, we finally got the Republican answer to the Affordable Care Act. The American Health Care Act, as it's called, passed two important committees in Congress. We're going to talk about the plan now and what potential changes could mean for all of us. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein covers healthcare from the health desk at WHYY. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Lizzie.
So much has been happening in the political sphere and legislation writing world on healthcare this week. Let's back up for a second. If you are a consumer, what are the big things you should be thinking about right now, and what don't we know yet?
Right. So let's break that up. What don't we know yet? We don't know a lot. And I think in a way that probably makes it easy for consumers to tune out. You know, this legislation is in its nascent stage. It's got a long way to go. It's got to move through the House. It's got to move through the Senate. There's going to be a lot of compromise. There's going to be a lot of back and forth. Let's not kid ourselves. The Affordable Care Act took months and months and months. This probably will go faster, but it's still a long way from being any kind of final product. So what does that mean if you're a consumer trying to think about your costs for 2018. I mean, there are a lot of people who are trying to anticipate that. I think this legislation that's moving through Congress right now might take effect in 2018, 2019, 2020. So consumers do need to be paying attention, particularly around who their doctor is, what providers they have that they want to go to, the prescription drugs that they're on. They need to kind of be taking stock of, I think, what their needs are and understand that what Republicans are talking about, Lizzie, is major and can touch lots of different aspects of health.
Congressional Republicans have had a lot of concerns about the ACA over the years. What are they trying to achieve with this bill?
They're trying to do a couple of things. I think one of them is that they really don't like the idea that the federal government is sitting there telling people they've got to buy a product, right? Like, that's what the Affordable Care Act does on one level. It says you have to buy insurance or face a penalty. Well, that doesn't fall in line with the Republicans' worldview of sort of a small government. So you've got that issue. That's something that they're trying to address. They're also trying to address how much money the federal government has been spending, and the money continues to grow in Medicaid. They think that that amount of money should be smaller. They think in general that amount of money should be smaller at the state level and at the federal level. And this is a way to curb that kind of spending. I think that they also are concerned legitimately here. I mean, we've seen real premium increases under the Affordable Care Act for the 9 million people who are buying insurance on the exchanges. And there's also insurers are leaving the market saying that they can't make any money. So there are fewer and fewer options for people. So that's where we are. But I think the big idea, which is shared with Democrats, is we spend too much money on healthcare. We're not getting the coverage, the quality of services that we need, so we've got to do something. And this is Republicans' attempt, earnest attempt at that question.
I covered the sort of genesis of the Affordable Care Act and its time in Congress. And one of the big things then was the statements from the big players in the industry, insurance, yeah, pharma, hospitals, et cetera. Do we have a read on where they stand right now?
Well, the American Hospital Association came out over the week saying they don't like it. The American Medical Association, the physicians, said they don't like it. That's huge. I mean, these two groups represent lots of interests here. And I think on one level, I think they don't like it because it means potentially what the Republicans have introduced, at least, would really cut into the number of consumers who have insurance. At least that's the concern that they have. And so that's less money in the pockets of hospitals and doctors. But I think even deeper, and to be a little more generous here, these people are in the business of doing no harm. And more than that, they want to see people be healthy. And I think there's some real legitimate concerns that the plan being introduced in the House could really lead to millions of people. I mean, maybe 10, 15, maybe more million people not having insurance. That's a tough pill to swallow, you know, and these people have lots of lobbyists in Washington. They are making those concerns known. And don't forget, Lizzie, that hospitals in particular are some of the largest employers in these communities. And so if the hospitals are going to their members of Congress and saying, what are you doing, Joe? What are you doing, Susie? That's going to have some kind of impact.
Medicaid expansion was a big part of the ACA. Where does Medicaid stand potentially now?
So what the Republicans are proposing to do is to roll back some of the Medicaid expansions that we saw under the Affordable Care Act. So some of the new people who make like $16,000 a year who are now eligible and do not have children, they would no longer be eligible under the Republican plan starting in 2020. But beyond that, what they really want to do, and this is fundamental, I mean, this is like historic with a capital H. Republicans want to cap how much federal dollars go to the states to help cover Medicaid costs. Right now, it's sort of an open-ended match. And so we're talking about states losing, one estimate I saw talking about losing $400 billion over the first decade. This is going to have an enormous impact on consumers, potentially the people on Medicaid, the kinds of services they get covered, who is covered. I mean, we're talking about older seniors, we're talking about children, we're talking about low-income people, and also people who are disabled. And so these people, these consumers need to be thinking, potentially being ready, bracing themselves for real changes to the services that they receive.
Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein from the Health Desk at WHYY. Thanks so much, Dan.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Earlier in the show, we talked about immigration and farm jobs in California. Now we're going to look at a different aspect of immigration and the tens of thousands of immigrants from India who come to work in the U.S. on short-term visas. President Trump has warned that he's considering cutting back on those visas. And as with many things in economics, that could have unintended consequences that benefit India's giant software industry. From our partners at the BBC, Justin Rowlatt has this story.
This is a story about unintended consequences. I'm going to try and cross one of the busiest roads in Bangalore. Here we go. Bangalore is the center of one of India's fastest growing industries, IT. As the IT sector has blossomed, so has the traffic. There we go. Phew, I am over. But India's IT wallahs are worried.
We will bring back our jobs. We will bring back our borders. We will bring back our wealth.
Yes, Donald Trump speaking at his inauguration. His administration has warned that putting America first could mean restricting the number of visas it issues to foreign professional workers. And because India's IT sector is by far the biggest beneficiary of those, that is a huge issue here in India. R. Chandrasekhar runs the Indian IT Industry Association, NASCOM.
Undoubtedly, the ability to cause damage is there. But the ability to cause damage without damaging its own economy is highly questionable. That's the reality.
India's IT giants will certainly suffer, and that is an issue for the whole country, because India's $150 billion IT industry now accounts for some 10% of the country's total output. But the sector is changing rapidly, which is where those unintended consequences come in. There's a vigorous game of table football going on at one end of Phenomena's offices, and at the other end of this online finance startup, a group of software engineers sit on bar stools nursing cappuccino as they worry over some coding conundrum. The founder of the business, 26-year-old Riddhi Mittal, is excited by what a US visa clampdown could do for her business and for India.
Now I couldn't be happier. So now we're developing. We're going to grow exponentially over the next decade, right? There's just a confluence of macro factors and trends, which is going to be wonderful for here. And we need smart people here.
The Indian government has been lobbying the US hard to stop any change in professional visas. But when pressed, Amitabh Kant, the bullish civil servant who's been charged with the modest task of transforming India, cannot contain himself.
India is growing at 7.6% an annum. It's an oasis of growth in the midst of a very barren economic landscape. But when these people come here, India will probably start growing at 9 to 10% per annum. So no issue at all. We welcome people, but the loser will be America.
What he's describing is a reverse brain drain, and it's likely to have long-term effects.
Can I have a Bangalore bliss?
Yes, sir. In the evening, Riddhi and her friends chill out in a craft brewery. These days, India can offer all the amenities of California, but at a cut price. So any IT professionals who do return are more likely to stay and to develop new businesses. Businesses that could end up competing with the US companies they used to work for.
That's the BBC's South Asia correspondent, Justin Rowlett. We're going to turn back to farms now. If you were a sentient being in the 1980s, there's pretty much no way you escaped hearing this.
Ooh, I heard it through the grapevine. Ooh. Raisin of California sunshine.
California raisins from the California vineyards. Don't you know that I...
Those are the California raisins. Claymation raisins singing their produce-centric version of a Marvin Gaye song in a series of TV ads. I mean, come on, we had to play it. California raisins were king then. But the state's Central Valley, where they're farmed, is vulnerable to changes in weather, food trends, and competition in the market. And California raisin farmers are losing out. Marketplace's Andy Euler has been reporting on the story, and he joins me now. Hi, Andy.
Hey, Lizzie. How are you?
So what happened? I mean, how did we get from, you know, the, like, iconic claymation raisins, which, of course, we had to mention, to this?
Well, see, that's the thing, is that it didn't necessarily happen overnight. You know, Turkey is kind of taking the reins as the king of the raisins right now. They're producing more than California for the first time in history. But it's not just Turkey that's doing it. It's Iran is producing a ton of raisins, China, South Africa, Argentina, Chile. There's a ton of raisins being produced, and right now what's happening is we're actually producing 20% more than demand. And so that's what's happening in terms of the prices. That's why everything's sort of fallen. And Turkish raisins and other import raisins are actually cheaper than the ones you can get from California. So the packers are saying, well, that's the raisin. That's the product that we're going to buy. We're not going to buy these expensive California raisins, even though they're local. We're going to buy the Turkish raisins. Why not?
Why not buy the thing that's profitable?
Sure.
Yeah. So what causes profitability to change in this way? I mean, walk me through how, I guess, the international raisin market works.
So everybody you talk to out in Selma, California, the raisin capital of the world, tells you that California raisins are a better quality product. But if we can buy these Turkish raisins cheaper, that's what we're going to do. And the other thing is that it's not just necessarily the raisins that you get in that little sun-made box. Raisins go to things like bird feed. And then they also sell these raisin grapes to places like that produce Gallo or places that produce Two-Buck Chuck, you know, the kind of $2 wine that you get at a Trader Joe's.
Yeah.
They're struggling with how to figure out an advanced technology in terms of how to make this raisin production more efficient. I actually went into the Chamber of Commerce there in Selma, California, and I talked to Bob Allen, who is the executive director there, and he sort of told me what was going on.
The cost of doing any business moves what you do. So you know, all of the modernization of picking grapes and growing on the vine, you know, let them drying on the vine, makes a difference to their production.
That's the thing, is that there's a bunch of different things that these raisin farmers are trying to do, but all of that costs money. And so they talk about how difficult it is to meet regulation. They talk about how difficult it is to hire labor, because if you're hiring people in California, they're getting minimum wage. And so $10.50 an hour for anybody who's either working on your farm or working in your processing plant, you know, that's a lot of money for these farmers to pay.
You know, I'm sitting here thinking about this, you know, on the weekend as someone who puts raisins on my oatmeal.
Sure.
and thinks about this as a consumer. But if you are a farmer, if you are someone in Selma who you talk to, you've got to pivot here in order to make money. And you cannot do that overnight. You can't just switch crops. So what do they do?
That's another point, too. You're right. It's difficult when you're talking about produce and you're talking about farming, because, you know, when you plant these raisin vines, you know, when you plant these grape vines, it's going to be a couple of years before they even start producing. So if you want to pull them out and say you want to plant clementines or you want to plant almonds, it's not like they're just going to start producing immediately. And the cost of pulling out those vines, the cost of pulling those raisins out of the ground in Selma is really, really expensive. So it's not like, you know, okay, we're just going to give up on these raisins and we're going to put something else in and that's just going to sort of work out. They can't necessarily even get the funding from the banks because the banks don't think that it's actually viable for them to pull out these vineyards in, you know, because almonds make more money right now. Clementines make more money. So that would, of course, be the move if you're going to keep farming here. But pivoting and figuring out what you're going to do next is super expensive and also, like you said, takes a long time. So all these farmers are trying to figure it out, and a lot of them are just selling.
Yeah, so what's next then for the small farms, for growers? What do they tell you?
So I talked to a farm. I went and spent an entire day with John Pabujan, who is an 80-year-old man. He has two sons, and his son used to run the packing plant. His son now works in almonds, and he has another son who's in construction. He also has two grandchildren who he's teaching how to farm, but he's sort of trying to tell them to go to school instead of farming, but it's in his blood. This is what his family has done forever.
My grandfather had 60 acres across the street from my dad, and they made raisins every year on that 60. They didn't have money then. They'd put me on the tractor, and my grandmother and grandfather used to pick up every roll, 60,000 rolls.
It's incredible. I mean, you talk to John, he sat there and talked to me. He literally put me in his truck. He was like, get in the truck, we're going to go around. And we drove around and looked at his 450 acres of raisin vineyards. He's trying to figure out, look, does it make any sense for me to pass this on to my grandkids? Should I tell them to just sell the farm? It's such an interesting time right now in a place like Selma because these farmers, this is all they know and this is all they've done, and they're trying to figure out if it makes sense anymore.
Marketplace's Andy Euler. Andy, thank you very much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
And that's our show for this week. Remember, you can always come talk to me or the team at marketplace.org, our Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Haley Hirschman and Eliza Mills, with help from Danielle Stevens. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Ben Talladay is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our general manager. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.